But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here with co-host Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. This weather is driving me crazy.
It's up, it's down, it's down, it's up. It's snowing, it's not, it's raining, it isn't. It's nuts. I can't play golf. I'm mad.
You know? I understand. Well, I mean, again, I guess traditionally this is sort of different opportunities with weather. It can be like we're seeing, or it could be an early spring.
Yeah. But we had that tease, right? A couple of days in the 60s there, and then all of a sudden, whoo, back down to 30. You know?
And then you hear what's going on across the country. There's tornadoes and all sorts of craziness.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be blamed on climate change, like we've never had a tornado
it
before.
Is. Yeah. They said that the desert air is increased. The desert geography is increasing going to the east and displacing the atmospheric pressures. And so now in the center of the central United States, we're having tornadoes, and they happen all at the same time, apparently.
You know, at the risk of, you know, sounding like a heretic, which I'm allowed to do, by the way, briefly, I don't know what's going to happen in 5 years. You're not allowed to say anything. But, you know, I remember acid rain. And acid rain was the big, you know, coming catastrophe. And if we didn't raise taxes and give the government more power, acid rain would end our lives. Then it didn't happen. So then it was global cooling. And I remember Ted Danson being on TV saying, you know, we're coming into a new ice age. And if we don't raise taxes and give the government more power, we're all going to freeze to death. It didn't happen. So then it was global warming, right? And Al Gore was running around in a private jet talking about, you know, carbon dioxide emissions. And if we didn't get it all together and give the government more power and raise the taxes, then, you know, we were all going to fall into the sea. And then that didn't work. So now it's climate change. Now it can go up. It can go down. It can be sideways, this, that, and the other thing. And if we don't give the government a little more power and raise our taxes and redistribute the wealth, then we're all going to die. In 12 years, by the way.
You're listening to Focus on Long Island, Political Edition. But to continue in that
You brought it up.
I know. We're not talking about food at the moment. But what's interesting. Food for thought. You said something very interesting. You said something, emergency powers.
Yeah.
The pandemic has actually given a lot of politicians supposedly temporary emergency additional powers. And the problem is they can't get them back.
Well, I mean,
legislators are trying to rescind this order, emergency order, and they're having problems. Actually, in New York is a prime example of that. And it seems that all of Governor Cuomo's problems and issues.
He's got a few.
God, there's so much going on. And you wonder, as far as relaxing the restrictions on dining and where you can go and groups of people and quarantining. And you wonder if if he's just trying to divert the attention from this other situation going on.
Well, I'm sure there's some of that happening. I mean, you know, I think you have to have a little bit of a touch of megalomania to be a politician anyway. I mean, what do they call it? Hollywood for ugly people or something? You know, there's big egos down there, you know. But I've never met or seen one, you know, politician who acquired more power that ever voluntarily gave it up. It's like, you know, these bureaucracies that they create. I mean, name me one bureaucracy that was ever created to solve a problem, solved it, and disbanded. I mean, it just becomes this ongoing thing that never, you know, never stops. So I don't know. I'm always a little bit suspect. You know, I'm not one of those guys running around the woods in Michigan, you know, with a camouflage on, but you know, the bottom line is I'm always suspicious of government. I think we do well to do that. And the sad part is now, I mean, it's the newspaper's job, the journalist's job to kind of hold, you know, their feet to the fire. And I don't see that anymore. I see it's become agenda stuff. You know, one news station is on this side, one news station is on that side. And they're not reporting the news. They're reporting what they want you to think, you know.
So that's interesting you say that, too. And again, you're listening to Long Island Politics. I was told to listen to, like, the BBC News to get a more evenly opinionated report, because there's definitely agendas on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's quieted down a little bit, but it's still going on. Once the Trump era was over, it calmed down a little bit. But there's definitely still agendas.
Well, I watch these things, and it's funny. You know, when they had a border crisis in the beginning of the Trump administration, is why are you putting kids in cages? You know, then you get George Stephanopoulos that looks at, you know, President Biden says, what flavor ice cream do you like? You know, how does it feel to be in the White House? I mean, it's handled completely differently. You know, they're tossing these softball questions at, you know, a policy that's been at best an abject disaster, you know.
And Tom, this might be our last show because on the news this morning, I heard that President Biden has called out Putin and said he's responsible for doing something bad, and he's going to pay.
Okay.
And then the reporter asked, beat him up, what does that mean? And he said, wait and see.
Yeah, just wait and see. Yeah, we'll see. Anyway, forgetting all of that, because now I'm going to get mad, and then we're going to have an hour's worth of this stuff. So anyway, you know what? We opened the club a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half ago, and I hadn't been anywhere during the time that we were closed down. We were closed down from, I guess it was, middle of middle of January to the middle of March, right? So normally I go away and I go down south and play golf for a week, but my friend Dave is, he's diabetic, so he didn't want to get on a plane, you know, without the vaccination, the whole thing. So we didn't go anywhere, right? So anyway, about 2 days before we open the club, it's a Sunday, and I'm like, I got to do something. I can't just sit here. So I jump in the car, right, and I'm talking to my daughter. She says, what are you doing today? I said, I don't know. I'm going to go take a ride upstate, you know. So I scoped out a couple of things. There's this Resorts World up there, you know, the casino.
Yes, right off of
17.
And the
Catskills, yeah. I said, maybe I'll take a ride up there, you know. And then I'm kind of thinking about what to do. So I get in the car, and I'm like, you know, I've never been to Woodstock. I mean, I've always wanted to go.
That's right in that area.
Yeah. So I said to myself, well, you know, I was going to go the first time, you know, and we had access to tickets when I was a kid, and I was going to go with these two friends of mine. My friend, they were,
so what, Terry, were you about 15, 16?
Yeah, I was 16 years old, and Terry was like 22 or 21, my friend Terry. And we worked in this restaurant together, but the boss wouldn't let us off for the weekend, you know? It was a weekend gig. So anyway, we didn't go. And who knew what it was going to turn into? And I'm kind of glad I didn't go because it was a mess up there anyway. I mean, you know, between the, you know, the problems with water and the mud and the rain, the whole thing, you know.
With my short-term memory issues, I wouldn't have known if it was the blue LSD or the red LSD that
yeah,
was good. You know, they had all
you'd have known after. But anyway, it's been glorified, you know, and romanticized all these years because it was Woodstock. But it was a mess, you know. Anyway, so I decided to go to Woodstock. Let me go to Woodstock, right? So Gene is always telling me, you know, use your GPS, you know. I'm like, I don't know. I know how to get pretty much everywhere, you know. And if I don't, I'll ask, you know. Anyway, so I punch Woodstock in, and it says 2.5 hours, right? It says, okay, so off I go. So I'm driving. I kind of like driving by myself because I can listen to what I want. It's kind of, you know, peaceful. I can think about menus. I can do what
I
want. It's
so funny because I just had this conversation with somebody, and there is a big difference between driving yourself or driving with your
your
other half.
Definitely that. But even a friend, you know, I mean, shut up. I don't want to listen to you. I want to listen to what I, anyway. So I'm driving up there, and I'm having a ball. I'm just, okay, this is a good day. And I figured maybe I'll go to Woodstock, and I'll shoot over to Resorts because it's 18 minutes away, so I thought. And, you know, it'll be a fun day. And I'll watch the end of the golf match at the hotel room. I'll, you know, go have dinner in the steakhouse. Scott Conant has a steakhouse up there, Saleo or whatever. And I'll come home the next morning, go to work. Okay. So I'm about 2 hours and 15 minutes in. And I'm saying, okay, this is great. And all of a sudden, now it says another half an hour. And then a half an hour after that. And finally, now I'm driving all over the place. And I'm closing in on it. It says 2 minutes down the road. And I'm looking at this road, and I'm like, all right, you know, I guess we're getting close to Woodstock. And then it tells me 2 minutes later, you've arrived. At who? Mrs. Woodstock's house? I'm in the middle of a neighborhood. You know what I mean? It took me to the room. And this isn't the first time it's happened to me, right? So it took me to this neighborhood. So now I'm PO'd, right? So I punch in an address in Woodstock, like, you know, 350 Main Road or Main Street or whatever. And it says I'm 38 minutes away. So now I drive another 38 minutes. I finally get into Woodstock, like, almost 3.5, 4 hours later.
The town? Bethel?
Bethel, that's where, yeah. So I get into Woodstock, and the problem is there's no parking. The place is crowded because it was kind of a nice day, and everybody's walking around. And I'm like two Snapples into a one Snapple trip, if you get my drift, right? So I'm afraid to stand up straight because I'm going to wet my pants if I can't find a men's room, right? So I'm driving all around. I get mad. I can't stop. I can't find a parking spot. Now I'm furious, right? I said, well, I'll go to Resorts and, you know, I'll go have dinner at a steakhouse. I'll feel better. So I punch in Resorts International or Resorts with Catskills or whatever. And it says what I thought. It said 18 minutes away, right? So I said, all right, that's not bad. So I make a right out of it. I can wait 18 minutes, you know. So I make a right. I'm going and I look down and it's an hour and 18 minutes. And I'm like, what? I'm not going to make an hour and 18 minutes. So now I punch in. Because I know I'm kind of close to Poughkeepsie, so I punch in Culinary Institute of America because I know where I am if I get there, right? So it takes me over to Rhinebeck Bridge or whatever. I finally get, so I wind up in Rhinebeck, which I haven't been to in probably 40 years, you know? And it's a beautiful town. I don't know if you've ever been up there. Rhinebeck is gorgeous. I mean, it's just really, it's like an upstate-y, you know, kind of looking town. And it really is. It's just gorgeous. So I'm driving around, and I got to get to a men's room, right? So
again, you're two snapples into a
half a snapple trip because I'm another hour in a car, and I'm cross-eyed, right? So I get out of the car, and I'm walking bent over. You know, I see this Gigi's Italian Bistro. So they got a tent out front. People eating in the tent. Says, all right, let me go in there, right? So I go into Gigi's. I sit at the bar. I'm talking to the bartenders. I order a glass of Macan Village, which is a beautiful little Chardonnay from France. I have an octopus appetizer, and I, you know, like Usain Bolt, go to the men's room, right? So I come out, and I finish, you know, I'm talking to the lady, and she's very nice, the bartender, and the food was decent, you know, it was a good, you know, appetizer. And so, but I'm looking to have dinner somewhere. I'm looking to go, you know, so I'm punching in, you know, best Zagat-rated restaurants, Poughkeepsie, and I've been to that one, I'm not interested. Yeah, maybe I'll go there. They got a good wine list. Okay, so I'm driving back down to Poughkeepsie, which is, I don't know, 20 minutes south or whatever, you know. I pass Culinary Institute, and there's a place called Shadows on the Hudson up there, which I had been to before with one of my ex-roommates. And they have a great little, wine system there, so they have better wines by the glass. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe I'll do that. But if I do that, then I can't really drive all the way home, you know. So I have to get a motel room up here. And do I want to just sit in a motel room in Poughkeepsie, you know, so I kept driving. So I wind up not stopping, coming all the way home and having dinner in East Norwich, 5 minutes from my house, right?
And what restaurant was that?
I went to Hunter, the new place. It's on the corner of 106 and Northern Boulevard, just north of Northern Boulevard on 106. It used to be Girasol for a while. It was a Black Walnut years ago, and it was something else. I can't remember. But it's been there a while.
Diagonally across from Rothman's.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, and there I am. I'm sitting here. I could have, you know, 8 hours in the car, you know what I mean? Except for like a half an hour at a bistro in a bathroom, you know? And I'm right back where I started. I should have just sat in the house, watched TV, you know? I burned a tank of gas, you know, got all kinds of, you know, aggravation. It was like, nice day out, you know, nice day for a ride. You ever spent 8 hours in the car?
I have.
I could have been to Boston and back. I could have had dinner in Boston and came back. Instead, I had dinner a half a mile from my house. It was just one of those days. It's one of those days where, you know, when you wake up and I don't know if the stars align or misalign or whatever, where you just know that everything you do is going to go wrong. You just have that feeling early on. That was it.
It happens. It's funny. I guess, what are some of the towns near Poughkeepsie? There's like a university, there's a state university near one of them.
Yeah, New Paltz up
there.
New
Paltz is what I was thinking of. My friend's family had a bed and breakfast up in New Paltz.
Uh-huh.
So, and then my kids went to school upstate. So we would draw, and then I guess Kerry's kids go to camp in Pennsylvania, and you sort of go that way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we would drive through Woodstock, and I guess there's a 17 and a 17A. And I don't know how to go anywhere. And
I was probably on both of them.
And I don't pay attention to the GPS, so I'm always getting lost too. But when you drive through that area, and again, you know, the so-called Woodstock area, first of all, it's interesting because you see a lot of guys with prayer shawls and yarmulkes.
That's the Catskills, yeah.
So you have that. But then you quickly pass through, and then there's this, like, eclectic, antique-y crafts-like area. And I never actually got the chance to stop there, but my parents were always driving in that area for business and stuff, and who knew? They would be going to Woodstock all the time, and they loved it. But that area is supposed to be great. There's some music festival that you sit out on the lawn. And many of the acts that play at Jones Beach Amphitheater during the summer include that in their tours. And I have a friend that goes there. You bring your own chair and you sit on the lawn. And it's supposed to be wonderful.
Yeah, who's the drummer from the band? That band?
Rich Danko.
No. The other one. God, I can't think of his name now. Begins with an L. Levon Helm.
Yes.
Levon Helm. He had a house up in Woodstock.
Well, did the band record that record
music
up
at Big Pink? Yeah. But Levon Helm actually played with my friend Michael Meehan, the chef from. He's got a couple of restaurants now in Huntington, Vauxhall and Burrito Bar, and he's got a band. He's a great bass player and a good songwriter. And anyway, he had Levon Helm was playing with his band for a while before he passed away. You know, and I think Daryl's House, that music show. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Daryl Hall from Hall and Oates. He does a thing up. I think he's got a farm up there, and he's got a music studio, and he invites people up, and they film it. You know, like these. I've seen Joe Walsh there, and Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top. You know, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of a fun thing, but it's a beautiful area up there. You know, if you can find it. I couldn't find it. It took me 4 hours to find a 2.5-hour ride, you know. And I'd like to go again if I have a little time. And it's kind of cool because everything is, you know, is Woodstock-related up there, obviously. You know, every you know, there's, you know, guitar-shaped things and, you know stuff, memorabilia in the windows. And it's pretty cool.
I don't know. On my bucket list, I got to stop at the Roscoe Diner. I've never been there. Everybody talks about it.
The Phoenicia,
right
too,
on 17 or whatever.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an interesting area up there, you know. I worked in the Catskills years ago when I was going to school as a bartender in a place called the Laurels. And it was one of those old, you know, kind of Jewish resorts. It's always been a haven for, you know, New York to go up.
The so-called Catskills area, which I guess you're explaining is a little bit off from
the Woodstock
area. But you had all these, the Raleigh, the Neville, the Granite, Kutcher's.
Kutcher's, Grossinger's, you know.
And those places were pretty cool. I guess the only remnant of that now is the Italian one.
Yeah, the Neville or whatever.
Roma?
Villa Roma.
Which is, I guess, the Italian version. But, oh, my God, that's a whole experience that is so memorable. You used to go to these hotels, and it was food included.
The Concord
was
another.
Much alcohol, but it was food included.
Yeah,
and it was like going on a cruise. You know, people just all of a sudden, you know, would order 14 different things.
Sure, yeah. I'll be here all week. Try to veal. All these comedians up there.
It's funny. So growing up, they used to call them bungalow colonies. Families used to The dad would stay back in New York, and the family would go up there for essentially day camp.
And a resort area.
So did that when I was young, and then scoot forward a bit when I had a family, and we always traveled with my in-laws, and we went to one of those places. And my kids were really young, and they were really, I guess the other guests there were really happy to see us there because my kids were terrible. You know, they would take the tray from the baby seat and throw it across the room.
But
some really cool experiences going forward. I always was into music. You were mentioning music.
Sure.
And I got to see the Righteous Brothers perform.
Love
up
those
there.
Guys.
And but like I was there for the rehearsal.
Oh, were you?
So it was like behind the scenes.
Sound check,
and it was like, oh, my God, it can't get any better than this.
No, it's like a personal
and
concert.
And then, you know, I must have been like 20-something years old, was in this family business, but music was my thing. But that was just so cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, here I am working in the music industry at a radio station.
Yeah, look at you.
Sitting across Chef Extraordinaire. I'm sure.
Yeah, Chef. Yeah, it's you know, I had a Twilight Zone experience up there. You know, when the Concord was still, I don't know if it's still open. I know the hotel isn't open, but they had like a smaller building that was like, it looked like a 2-story motel. And I used to go up there and play the golf course, the Monster, you know, which was always in pretty good shape. And I'm going back now, probably 15, 18 years. But so I went up there. My friend was going to meet me there the next day. So I went up the day before and stayed over. I played a round of golf and I stayed over at the hotel. So I went out to this steakhouse. It was Homestead, it was called. You know, it was really the only quote-unquote upscale restaurant in the area. So I get there, and it's kind of like this old upstate-y building, you know, kind of thing. It's been around a while, and I'm sitting at the bar. I'm the only one at the bar. There's a couple people in the dining room. It wasn't very busy. It was early. It was like 6, 6:30, something like that. And they had this extremely surprisingly good wine list. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool, you know. And I'm not a steak guy, but I can suffer through, you know, sirloin if I have to, you know. So I'm drinking this very cool wine, and I'm talking to the bartender. And I said, you know, I used to work here 100 years ago in a place called The Laurels. He goes, really? He said, you know, one of my best friends worked at The Laurels. I said, well, how long ago? And he goes, oh, a long time ago, you know. I said, well, the only reason I remember this guy's name is his name was Bernie Israel. And the only reason I remember his name, he was the head bartender, and he had a chain with the Star of David on it. And I always, you know, I was connected to Israel to the Star of David thing. So, you know, his name always stuck in my head. And I said, you know, there was a guy who was very kind to me when I got up here. I was a little kid. He was like the head bartender, and he took me under his wing and showed me what to do and this, that, and the other thing. He was a very nice guy. His name was Bernie Israel. He goes, you know Bernie? Bernie was my best friend. That's who I'm talking about. I said, are you kidding me? He goes, no. Bernie and I were friends for 60 years. I said, no kidding. How is he? He passed away last week. I'm like, hi. Oh, my God, you know. So anyway, I get there. This is the funniest restaurant story ever. Maybe not ever, but, you know, I'm sitting at the bar. So I said to the guy, you know, I'm going to have dinner. Can I have dinner at the bar? And he goes, no. I said, what? He says, no. I said, what do you mean, no? He says, no, you can't eat at the bar. I said, why? He says, house rule. I says, I can't eat at the bar. I'm sitting here. I can't eat at the bar. No. So I got to go in the dining room? He goes, no, you can sit at the table over there. So I said, I can eat in the bar. I just can't eat at the bar? I mean, it's a Jerry Seinfeld routine, right? So he goes, yeah. All right. So I ordered a salad and a steak or whatever, right? So I'm sitting there drinking wine, talking to him at the bar. My salad comes out. They put it at the table. I got to get off the bar stool. I go down to the table. I sit down. I eat my salad. I get up. I come back to the bar. I'm sitting at the bar, right? Have another glass of wine. I'm waiting for my entree. It comes out. They put it down on the table. I get off the bar stool, down to the table, right? Now I have the steak. Can I come up to the bar and get another glass of wine, or do I have to have a waitress bring it? No, you can't come to the bar. The waitress has to bring it. So now I got to flag down a waitress who's in the dining room with the other four people that are in the restaurant, right? So she comes over. Can I get you anything? Yeah, I'll take another glass of wine. So she goes to the bar, gets the glass of wine, brings it to the table. I finish. I get back up, go sit at the bar, have another glass of wine. It's like insane. Absolutely insane.
Did you tip yourself?
No, I tipped the waitress. I tipped the bar. You know, I spent more money in tips than I did at dinner, you know. It was just the most hysterical thing ever, you know. I felt like it was in some kind of a Fellini movie or so, like transported back to a different
scene
time.
Was like Fellini. I mean, it was actually you're making my mind work. So my memory is
there's
like
a first.
So actually, also when we were in college, I was in a fraternity. I was in ZBT up at Syracuse, and we had a weekend formal or something, and we were a bunch of Jewish guys in an affluent fraternity.
Yeah.
So we went to one of these Catskill resorts.
Yeah.
And I remember, first of all, it was all inclusive. You know, they had sports facilities.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Ice skating.
Yeah, it was everything
and,
there. Sure.
But the food was interesting. It was definitely Jewish soul food.
Yeah, it's, you know, catering.
Anything
sure.
from the, you know, gefilte fish and, yeah. and the chopped liver, which is a crazy story. I'm busy. My mom has me doing all the shopping, and Passover is coming, and she goes, Stu, I need some rendered chicken fat. So I don't know where to get chicken fat. You know, in the old days, you went to the kosher butcher or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
So, but again, all this soul food. So I said, oh, Zorn's. They have this like affinity to Jewish food. They have matzo ball soup all year round, and they have the location in Bethpage. And
yeah.
So I said, oh, wow. They do the fresh turkeys and fresh chicken. They have chicken fingers. They must have fresh chickens.
Sure, yeah.
So I call up. Oh, would you like rendered or unrendered?
Yeah.
I said, I need rendered. I don't even know what that means. And they go, well, you have to order that. I said, oh, okay. I forgot to pick it up yesterday.
Oops.
I better go over there. At any rate, so I ordered my rendered chicken fat, and then they say, what size? So I don't know. In today's world, you measure things not by ounces, cups. It's the little soup container or the double soup container, yeah. The pint or the quart.
Sure.
So first I went to the quart. Then I said, I better check with my mom. What size do we need? You know, she goes, you got a quart? That's going to last for 10 years.
Perfect. Freeze
she
it.
She needs to make her chopped liver, so she needed that. But yeah. It's just so funny.
It is, you know, and you know, I'm the consummate smartest, you know what I mean? So I can't ever miss an opportunity to say something stupid, you know? So I'm driving through the Catskills with one of my nephews, right? And, you know, there's I can't remember which town, but it's a community of almost entirely Orthodox Jewish community there. And so everybody's walking
maybe
around.
Goshen?
Yeah, I don't remember. But they got the payas, you know, the curls behind the ears, the shawls, the yarmulkes, the whole thing, you know, and the black coats, you know, and then the hats and the whole thing. So my nephew was like 7, you know, he'd never seen anything like this before. So he goes to me, Uncle T, who are those people? I couldn't help myself. I said, Yankee fans. So he comes home, right? Mom, we saw, but shut up. Will you shut up? Don't tell her. I'm going to get in trouble. You know? Forgive me. Organized religion. I always have fun with it.
So it's funny. You were just talking about this trip upstate, and one of the ways you you judge a restaurant is by the wine list.
I do.
So let's take a detour and talk about food and wine.
Why would we do that? It's ridiculous.
So I was hanging at the radio station last week, and there were 3 of us still here, and somebody said, let's open a bottle of wine.
Uh-oh.
And I'm going to throw the cork over to you.
I got it.
This was a magnificent
Amacone, huh?
Red Italian wine.
Mm-hmm.
That was... It wasn't like a heavy wine,
right?
But it went down so smooth, and I just don't know if you have any insight to what that specific wine is.
I don't. Do you know what grape it was? Was it a Chianti?
It was like a Chianti.
Like a Chianti?
I'll have to bring the bottle, just the cork.
Yeah, I mean, that would help. You know what I mean? Identify the cork. What am I, a DNA specialist? You know? We send this to a CSI unit and find out what's going on.
Oh, there's a little bit of skin under the cap.
Boy, I'm telling you. He thinks I'm a genius. Yeah, well, let's talk about wine. I mean, I've had, you know, we're open now at the club again, so I got a parade of wine salesmen coming in and tasting me out on things. And I've tasted a couple of really cool things this week. And one is like an old favorite. I mean, it's for those who've never drunk Suave. And, you know, Suave is kind of like Pinot Grigio. It's gotten a little bit of a bad name because there are a lot of cheap ones out there that aren't made really well. But when it's made really well, it's a great grape. The grape is Garganega or Garganega. I mean, there's a couple of different pronunciations. I call it Garganega because it's easier for me to remember.
I almost always go to 2 words when you say Suave. I guess Bola had an incredible marketing campaign, and everybody, yeah. I probably, just like with Pinot Grigio, people go to Santa Margherita as
sure.
a go-to.
Yeah.
I guess Bola, Suave Bola.
Yeah, well, it became a euphemism for Suave. It was Bola, you know, and I don't want to judge what they did, but, you know, when you get those oceans of wine from one producer, you know, they're a little less serious about it. They're more about, you know, the business end of the, you know, spectrum rather than the artist's end. And, you know, I always look for the art, obviously. But Pieropan, 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 is, in my humble opinion, one of the best producers of Suave out there. And it's delicious. I mean, it has this real minerality to it that you don't normally get. And it's kind of a little Pinot Grigio-ish, if I had to, you know, describe it to the non-Suave drinker. It's kind of like that, but it has a little more moxie and a little more earth and chalkiness to it, which I find really refreshing. It's a great food wine, too. It goes great with light fish and, you know, like flounder or
so
halibut.
So what brought this top of mind? Were you at a restaurant and you chose that?
No, one of my salesmen brought it for me to taste, you know, with a bunch of other things. He brought some interesting things. He brought a Pinot Grigio from Yerman, which is a producer up north that used to be like Yugoslavia.
It's just a little west of Santa Margherita?
It's just a little west of, there is no Santa Margherita, by the way. Yeah, a little west of the Santa Margherita vineyard. Which doesn't exist. But anyway, Yerman, Jerman, when you get to northern Italy, a lot of that, there's a Germanic influence there from Switzerland or whatever, you know. But they do a great job with white wines from the lower end spectrum, like the Pinot Grigios, which are, he does serious Pinot Grigio, which is a fun grape to drink, to these very expensive, you know, my cost $100 a bottle blends of.
Which leads me to the question, how does the wine selection differ at a club as compared to a restaurant in price point? Because you assume that people that belong to a club, it's a little more affluent, targeted, income-based group as compared to a restaurant, which might be more varied. So what is the price point? Well, people don't really see that. I don't know how you order it at a club.
It's kind of I've only been in the club for a year, so I can't speak for the rest of them, but I can speak for this one. The wine selection at this club when I got there was less than
stellar.
Stellar, yes. Very good. Was less than stellar. And we had to, what's a good word for get rid of? We had to market some wines to kind of alleviate some excess in the cellar, this stuff that had been piling up that nobody ordered. So we did that. And there's techniques to do that, you know, which I'm familiar with. Anyway, the interesting part about the club is there's, or clubs in general, is there's this prevailing thought that since I'm paying so much to be a member here, some of the food and wine should be a little less expensive, which is kind of counterproductive, because what happens is, you know, the money that you're paying to be a member of the club is pretty much going for, you know, leaving the door open when the air conditioner is on, you know, the greens, the, you know, the tennis court refinishing, all the other stuff. And they tend to lose a lot of money with the food, you know, end of the business. And so you have a lot of clubs now going broke because of the excess that these people were demanding. You know, the older, you know, people in the club, they were used to having these bread bars and these big buffets with lobsters and tigers and bears, oh my, and oysters and this and that, and free hors d'oeuvres before cocktail hour. And, you know, economically, you can't sustain that. And what happens is when it gets to the point where now they're going broke, they need to assess the members. The members go, well, I ain't paying an assessment. I'm going to this other club because they're offering, you know, and they kind of abandon it, you know. So you've had some clubs, and I'm not going to mention who they are because it doesn't matter. But the bottom line is there's some clubs that are being sold now, you know, because they're going broke, you know.
It's interesting, based on what you were just saying, in my logic, if you're paying a fee, and it might be that you have a $5,000 food budget.
Yeah.
It's like, it becomes, in my mind, if I was involved as a patron, the Las Vegas syndrome, where all of a sudden, you know, if I normally would spend $20 on a bottle of wine, a $100 bottle of wine doesn't bother me. So if I saw on the menu a $50 or a $60 bottle of wine, I wouldn't think twice about it because it's all, I already spent that money.
Sure, yeah.
It's already in the bank and in my account.
On the check, yeah, and of course.
It doesn't feel as painful.
Well, you know, it's funny that regardless of what your status is financially, people appreciate value at whatever level, and value comes in different, you know, levels. I mean, there's value in a Ferrari at $275,000, you know, if you have that kind of money, you know. If you have enough for a Volkswagen, there's no value in that Ferrari. That's just crazy, you know.
Yes, and it's funny you say that because I was down in Florida a couple of weeks ago, and a family I met, the gentleman sold his business for $100 million.
Yikes.
That's a pretty nice culmination of a business career. But down in Florida, they drive around in this red Beetle.
Uh-huh.
It is a turbo Beetle and everything. Yeah, yeah. But the joke is, and it's sort of in line with what you were saying, they say, my little red Corvette. In their vision, that's what it is. But it doesn't matter. It's a vehicle to get them around for a short period of time. And his buddies are driving around in Bentleys and Maseratis. He's got this little red Corvette,
sometimes,
which is really a Volkswagen.
It's how you brought up, you know. I mean, I had a partner who had a $1 billion business, and he, same thing. He drove a 96 Range Rover, and I said to him one day, I said, hey, Mark, how do you stay so grounded? I mean, you got this wildly successful thing that he built from nothing, you know. Genius, really, you know. And I said, how do you stay so grounded? He goes, you know, it's just what I do. He says, you'd be the same. I said, are you kidding? I'd be insufferable if I had your money. You know, I'd be a complete jerk. That's why, you know, God won't let me have it, you know, kind of thing. You know? So, but it's, you know, I think that, you know, getting back to the original question, I mean, the price tag of wines in the rest in the club differ with different people. We have one guy who, you know, he likes big California cabs. It doesn't matter what they cost. And, you know, he'll spend, you know, $180, $200 on a bottle routinely when he comes in. We have other people that, you know, like question, you know, like, why are you trying to screw us with these prices, you know? So it really comes down to, you know, the individual. But I think that, you know, what I try and do is I try and, when I put a wine list together, I try and give, you know, an across-the-board spectrum, and I try to give everybody a shot at it, you know. I have what I consider great wines for $30, $35 on the list. I have great wines for what I consider great wines for $300 on the list. And just because it's $300 doesn't mean it's a good wine. I personally make sure by tasting all these wines, A, because I love to, and B, because I want to know what's out there. And I've tasted, you know, let's say 10 wines at $300 that, you know, some I wouldn't give you $100 for and some I would have paid $1,000. So it's kind of, you know, to me, I'm just trying to give them the complete experience. And the thing that I've run into at the club is there's a lot of people, and I think this is kind of a normal, I think more so on Long Island that I've noticed, is that we tend to be label shoppers. And it's not just wine. If you go to the Americana, you know, in Manhasset, every store is a, you know, is a, you know, Coach,
in
it's Prada,
world,
it's Hirschfelder.
It's got to be, and you might be talking about label shopping differently than I. You're saying that people would only go and buy a Kendall Jackson or a Kim Crawford or whatever.
Silver Oak. Or...
But I'm actually talking about label shopping because of the diversity and the artisticness of wine labels today.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. That's a different story. That's, you know, and that's a merchandising thing that people use to their advantage because there is some value in that, especially in a store, you know. But in a restaurant, you know, a lot of times they're not displayed, so you can't really do that. What I mean by label shopping is Mercedes instead of, you know, a Volkswagen or you know, Prada instead of
a
Macy's.
Because I know I'm not that knowledgeable about wines, but there are a couple of things that I like. Louis Jardin, I like the... Nouveau Beaujolais or Beaujolais
Nouveau
or their Poulet Fousse.
Yeah.
But and maybe I would go into get a Pinot Grigio and I would go right to the Santa Margarita. But when you have a store downstairs from the studio, like a wine shop like Stu Leonard's,
yeah.
I love to use the salespeople to educate me. And I'll say, you know, what about this Chardonnay? Well, this one is more smoky, and this one is that. And they directed you into, you know, different choices. But it's not, let's call it not a brand name or something familiar to me. But here's what came about with me recently. I was given a gift of a very nice wine. It's about $120, $150 or something.
Right, right.
And then I heard, and we talked about it on the show at one point, Conundrum.
Conundrum, yeah.
It's like a $25, $30 bottle of wine.
Camus, yeah.
Camus. And it was, I had it. It was very enjoyable. And I said to Carrie, I said, you know, I have this really expensive bottle, but does anybody appreciate it? You know, do I have to announce that it's a $200 bottle of wine? Or can I just say this is a nice wine that I found?
That's wine security or insecurity, depending on how you look at it. I mean, I think that I don't have a problem with people label shopping, buying wines for the sake of the, you know, I'll have a Silver Oak or I'll have the Jordan or whatever. I mean, if that's what you like, that's what you like. It's just that I'd like to, you know, try and affect a little bit of an education on people where, you know, I know you like that. Try this. Because there's an ocean of wine out there that's really good that people just limit themselves. We have a guy that comes into the club. The only wine he drinks is Jordan Cabernet. And I'm like, all right, well, I get the fact that you like it. You know what it's going to be. It's the same pretty much every year. And that's your go-to wine. But why on earth wouldn't you want to try, you know, if you're only dating brunettes and a blonde came by, why would you go, no, you know, I only date brunettes, you know? It just kind of seems silly to me to limit yourself like that.
And the logic of it all is that, you know, if you have 10 experiences and eight of them are perfect, and two of them are a little off base, well, does it really matter? You got to expand your palate and taste these different things, and if two nights you have a wine that's not to your expectation, oh, that's too bad.
Well, you have to know what bad is to appreciate good, right? I mean, otherwise, how would you know? You know, the bottom line is, I mean, if you drink this wine your whole life, every night.
Now you sound like my rabbi.
Yeah, well, it's...
Why do babies die? You know, he says, Stu, in life, you know, there's going to be good and there's going to be bad.
Yeah.
There needs to be a little bit of this unsettledness to have us appreciate what the good things in life offer.
I agree with him. Call me Rabbi Shodelowitz. But I think that in order to, you know, listen, one of the reasons I taste so many wines is, well, there's a myriad of reasons, but, you know, I want to make sure that I know what's out there so I can filter through that for my clientele, you know what I mean? And that's all I'm doing. Not all I'm doing, but I mean, that's the major purpose of me tasting wines for the restaurant is to filter out the stuff that's better than the stuff over here at the same price. I can taste 30 wines in the $10 to $12 range, you know, and I'll pick out the two best ones or the three best ones that I want and put them on the list. And I'll save you all that other thing. So here's a place you can go where you can absolutely trust, and it's going to be my palate for sure, but you can absolutely trust that I've gone through this and I've saved you the trouble of tasting
well,
all those other
that's
wines.
That's what's so cool about flighting. Many times, I guess there are wine flights, but I mean, again, to be able to sample six different wines at one meal is incredible. I mean, locally, there's actually a tequila bar that you can order a flight of tequila.
Sure.
And there's actually three different price levels.
Uh-huh.
And you say which one you want, and then it's like a multiple choice. And then you choose what you want from that. But it's a really cool experience. I think there's probably three or four
glasses in the
flight.
Yeah.
But doing that, I think I did something like that with you at Jewel. You used to offer something like that.
Yeah, flights, for those who don't know it, is a couple of different wines of the same either grape and or year. You can do different years too, which is called a vertical flight, you know, like 2007, 8, and 9, you know, so you can see the same wine in three different years, how it evolves. But a flight is like a flight of Chardonnay would be, you know, let's say a French Chardonnay, an Italian Chardonnay, an Australian Chardonnay, and an American Chardonnay, and you can taste the difference. You know, they give you small portions of each. And it's a fun way to explore wine. And look, you know, my Jordan wine drinker, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. But, you know, the bottom line is that there are so many good wines out there in every price category that it just seems a shame to me to limit yourself. And you know, I'm lucky because I get a chance. Like I said the other day, one of my salesmen came in. He brought me a Suave. He brought me a Vermentino. He brought me a Pinot Grigio. And he brought me an Etna Bianco, which is this odd grape, Caracante, from Sicily. You know, I don't know how many Caracantes you've drunk in the last 3 weeks, but I'm assuming it was none, you know. And that's the thing, that there's so many other options, and people go to that, you know, I'll have Chardonnay, I'll have Pinot Grigio, I'll have a Cabernet, you know, we used to sell, you know, I had probably 25 wines by the glass at Jewel. The two biggest movers were Pinot Grigio and Napa Cab. You know, Napa Cabernet, I'll have a Napa Cab. Do you have a Cabernet from Napa? Do you have a Cabernet? I'll have a Napa Cab. You know, it was always the same thing. And then the second one was, it used to be Merlot, but Merlot fell out of favor. The second one was Malbec. You know, I'll have a Malbec from Argentina. Now, I find them scratchy. I don't like them. You know, generally, I've had some higher-end Malbecs from Argentina that I can drink, but I'm not a Malbec guy until you get to France. And Cahors, if you look on the label and it says Cahors, that's a Malbec from France, you know. And I find them to be much more refined and nicer. It's a cooler climate. It's not as high in alcohol content, you know.
Well, going back to Jewel, it was really such an enjoyable part of the experience between the decor, the ambiance, is you could sit at the bar and have a wine by the glass, and the bartender or bartenders were knowledgeable to steer you in a different direction. And again, if you're having wine by the glass and you're just there for a so-called happy hour or whatever, you can go from glass to glass or whatever. But when you're talking about fun and enjoyment in this whole context of dining and wine, You know, we talk about the flight, which is a really cool experience opportunity, as is pairings. I mean, my education with wine and food comes actually through you. I talk about it all the time on the show. Is the most memorable was your birthday celebration.
the one I worked overtime on?
And then there was another one. There was the people from the out east that also, they do some beef farming now. I forget which vineyard it is.
Oh, McCall.
McCall.
Yeah.
That was the most fabulous. I mean, it just, again, you know, you have this most extraordinary food paired with incredible wines. And it doesn't stop till the end, because even when you're serving the dessert, it's paired with an unbelievable wine to finish the meal. And you, as the most creative chef that I know, and I don't know a lot of chefs, but that's not, I'm not dissing you. But when we dined and had a chef's menu with some of the people from the Wine Council, and Jim Waters.
Sure.
Somebody had come into you with a chocolate wine, and you said, don't serve this as a wine. Make me a dessert with it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's, you know, look, I think, and, you know, I've been immersed in this my whole life, but I think for me, there's nothing more entertaining than a great dinner. And for me, wine is the other half of it. I mean, I think that, you know, that food without wine is missing something to some degree. And I think there's so much pleasure in both. The bacchanalia of it all is, you know, what I'm always looking for. And, you know, when I go out, my wine bill is usually as high as my food bill.
Really?
I'm ashamed to say. But, yeah, it's like, why not? And, you know, the Wine by the Glass programs that have come so far in the last 20 years in a lot of restaurants, you know, is really the way to go, because you can have a white with your fish and, you know, and your appetizer, and a red with your meat if you go that way, or two different whites, you know, two different reds. And 99 times out of 100, if you look at a Wine by the Glass list and you're having a trouble deciding, you know, the bartenders will give you a taste. You know, hey, can I just try that, a little bit of that? And they'll give you a taste of it. You know, I mean, most restaurants are, you know, kind of, you know, benevolent that way, you know. And I think that that's just a fun way to eat it. You know, and
when
I get,
you talk about fun again, I have to share an old school dining experience that I had last week. Frank's Steakhouse, two locations. There's Jericho.
Yeah.
And there's,
I used
Rockville
to work
Center.
In that building in Jericho years ago.
Really?
Yeah, 100 years ago as a kid.
So I've never dined at the one in Rockville Center.
Uh-huh.
And I had a need to gather with some people. And I have to tell you, for the people that are questioning dining in a restaurant or whatever, we were there on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. Literally, there was not a lot of people there. And the way And they did it right. They seated people in the corners and then somebody in the center. But felt very comfortable. But when I say old school, the waiters, it was, you know, dressed up and they had the apron, but just so professional. And I didn't expect it from there. And we ordered martinis, and it comes in the shaker glass with the strainer.
Sure.
It was just such a cool experience. And the food was incredible. I guess maybe I'm starved from not eating out, but it was just, it exceeded all expectations.
Cool.
You know, they have a skirt steak that's, sometimes when you get skirt steak, can be very stringy and tough, like butter.
Yeah,
you could cut it with your fork. It was incredible. I had something which I don't really understand, but it was a filet mignon on the bone.
Yeah.
I mean, I know if you get porterhouse, it's sirloin on one side,
filet on
the other.
Yeah.
But it just was different. But it was... And it was so much food, I didn't even get to chew off the bone. But it was just excellent. The only thing that I didn't care for was the rolls. But all things considered.
Yeah, well, listen, that's a big part of it. I mean, you know, you got to pay attention. You know, restaurants are detail business. And I think that it's like the chain with the weakest link. You know, you got 100 pounds here, 80 pounds there. It's only as strong as the weakest link. And you can be disappointed by odd stuff. I mean, you know, he owes me more than anything is hard butter.
Well, that's what I was just going to go. That was where I was going to. So, exquisitely, in my mind, fancy but not ostentatious. It was just, you know, it's not a place you're going to go for a $20 dinner.
Sure.
But it was just, everything was just worth it. It was just great. But I didn't enjoy the rolls. Big deal. But I'm going to ask you the question of serving butter in individual plastic
sealed
containers.
Oh, God, please, no. I could punch somebody in the face when I see that.
That turns me off.
Yeah.
And then you're going to what you're saying is hard butter. And what's the rule with that? If you get served slices of butter, should it be like sort of soft?
Yeah, I mean, spreadable, you know. I think spreadable is the word that you're looking for, you know. I mean, because that's what you're going to do with it, you know. If it's hard, it's going to get that lump in the middle of the roll. It's a detail business, and you have to pay attention to the details. I mean, and that's one of them, you know. I mean, bread's a big thing for people.
So I have to tell you one other story, and I'm sorry to just be taking so much control of the show today, but I'm just...
This is the Stu Schrager show, playing with Stu.
So I have a client that lives in New Jersey. She grew up on Long Island, right. And second marriage. They're apparently living in a nice big house in New Jersey. And for some reason, we talk about food and wine.
Nice.
And she mentioned along the way, because I wanted to get her a wine for Christmas or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she mentioned she has a cellar full of wine.
Nice.
You know, so much that they'll never be able to drink. And I think
they got to practice more.
Talked about it that, you know, what I think is pretty cool is, you know, if they went in the direction of for holidays, giving bottles of wine from their cellar.
Sure.
It's like a thought process. Well, I think you would enjoy this, you know, and have the experience of they know what it's all about.
Right.
But the pandemic story that comes out of this is, and you will appreciate this, they're taking their first vacation, mm-hmm. and they're going down to North Carolina to Pinehurst.
Oh, yeah, sure, golf.
And I don't know what provoked me to say it. I guess it was because I recently traveled down to Florida by car.
Right.
They said they were driving.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, my God. What a perfect opportunity to liquidate some of the inventory in the wine cellar, and you can bring it with you.
Yeah.
And she goes, Stu, I can't believe you said that, because we are. The first thing I did when I made the reservation was asked about if we could bring our own wine and what the corkage fee would be.
Yeah.
And I'm sure this has to be a story in your book, one of your books, but... She said she called and they said it was $25.
Right.
Now, to me, that's a little high, and that's why it would show up in your book. But she said, you know, $25, and you know, when I'm dining, I know what I'm getting
because of course.
You know, I don't have to experience a new wine or whatever, and
yeah.
it just makes so much sense. So she said $25, and it's worth its weight in gold, and I have to believe that you have clients that over the years have asked you to bring their own wine or whatever, which you probably frown on, I'm guessing. But obviously you're entitled to a corkage fee.
Mm-hmm.
And what are people's reactions to that? And I guess it goes to the same thing with, I got to bring my own birthday cake.
Well, it's individual. I've had people say, you know, it's fine. And I've had people say, you know, I'll pull my own cork. Because they thought it was for, you know, opening the bottle. I said, you know, so I had to explain to them. I said, you know, the corkage fee isn't pulling the cork. The corkage fee is, you know, the opening the bottle, the washing of the glasses, the electricity, the, you know, the dishwasher fees, you know, all the other stuff, you know. And some people get it, some people don't, you know. My only requirements are, like, if you bring a bottle of wine, make it count. I mean, don't bring a bottle of Yellowtail in, you know what I mean? Bring a bottle of decent wine. Two is, it probably shouldn't be on our list. You know, if it's wine that's on our list, I tend to go, nah, you know, you can get that here. If it's something that's off our list, fine. And three, you know, I always say, you know, save a little bit for the owner. You know what I mean? Just do the right thing.
So my mind quickly wanders to something. We were talking about the Catskills or whatever. So in many Jewish homes in the old days, they would have wine glasses where the empty glass container that the Yahrzeit candle came in, which was the memorial candle that you lit. So, you know, if you had a lot of deaths in your family, you had a big collection of wine glasses. But which
great.
Is funny because when you go to the famous restaurant in New York City that's Family Style, I don't understand why I can't think of the name.
Yeah, I know which one you mean.
But,
I can't think of it either.
They serve the wine in those type of glasses. But what I'm coming to is, I'm always uncomfortable. Carrie and I, we have people over, and mostly wine drinkers. And she's got two of this wine glass and two of that wine glass or whatever. What's the most appropriate generic glass to serve wine in? I mean, you don't need the Baccarat crystal.
No, you don't. But,
and that's thin, and then you have the heavy fake crystal. And
yeah, you just want an all-purpose, you know, a bigger wine glass. Like, I go for those 17, 18, 20-ounce glasses so you can swirl it around and get some aroma. You know, you're talking about the Jewish candle thing. You know, that's in a Christian home, the equivalent was the Flintstone jelly jar.
Was caramel. Yes, that's what it is. That's what it is. It's sure. The jars of jelly. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. The candles come in and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Hilarious.
But again, it's Carmine's. And
Carmine's,
you see,
right. Yeah.
You have wine there, and they serve it in the simple, it's
yeah,
not
yeah,
a wine
yeah.
glass.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
a simple.
Yeah. They do that out in East Hampton, too, at a, can't remember the name, Italian restaurant right on Newtown Lane. Anyway, we have to end the Stu Schrager show with
Tom
Three Keys to Life.
You know, thank God you can't kick me under
this
the...
This is Stu's Three Keys to Life, or... Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And I may or may not be here next week. I don't know. We'll see.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.